The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. So, if I can get away with it with you all, I thought I would spend the evening talking about suffering. The Buddha once said that he only teaches two things, he only teaches suffering and the end of suffering. So I'll do half of it at least tonight. When the Buddha attained his awakening, it was an awakening that he experienced by himself, involving some deep insight, really a new way of seeing his life, this life, our world. Apparently he was first reluctant to teach because he felt that it was very hard to convey. It was very subtle what he had to teach, very difficult to convey, and he was inclined not to make the effort. But at some point he decided to try to teach some people, and he decided first he would teach five companions that he had in the spiritual life, spiritual circuit, seeking. And what's remarkable is that when he decided to seek them out, he had to walk 150 miles to go find them. Now, in the myth, at least, the story, the Buddha was somewhat emaciated at this point. And, he was supposedly barefoot. Maybe he had sandals on. And how long does it take to walk 150 miles across the plains of India if you're barefoot and somewhat emaciated, depending on eating just whatever the food people give you? I suspect that it took at least a couple of weeks, if not longer. And I'm struck by that he made that effort. That's quite something. He was intent to go teach some people, and he was willing to go that far in order to teach what he had to teach. It was so important for him, it was so important for them. And but when he showed up to see his company, he showed up at the little camp where his companions were. They saw him coming in the distance, and they made a pact that they would basically ignore him, because they had been they felt that he had turned away from the ascetic life that they had been practicing, and because before he became did his final piece of practice, he ate good food, he nourished himself a little bit, kind of built up his strength a little bit, and so they thought that he had fallen from the ascetic practice that they'd been doing. And so they thought he was a slacker or something. And so they said, let's just ignore him. But he came into their camp, and there was something about his presence that was so captivating for them, or so that they got up and received him, made a seat for him, and sat down. And then he wanted to teach them, and they said something like, no, you know. And he said, wait a minute. I've never talked to you this way before, with such authority and such clarity, like I really know. And they said, yeah, it's true, you never talked to us this way before. And he more or less said, well, give me a chance. But one of the things that struck me was the distance he walked. The other was that these people made a decision not to receive him, to ignore him. But there was something about his presence as he came into their camp that caused them to kind of give up their pact. And they stood up and made a seat and kind of had him sat down with him. There's something about his presence. Something about maybe the peace he had, or the love he had, or the clarity, or the sense of wakefulness, or something that was quite captivating for these people. And they were willing to listen to him. And then when he started to speak about what he had discovered, he gave the teachings called the Turning the Wheel of the Dharma, which is turning the teachings, offering the teachings for the first time, in the form of the Four Noble Truths. So he taught these four truths. And one of the ways of understanding these truths that the Buddha taught was that this was a new way that the Buddha had for seeing. That before his awakening, he saw the world one way. After the awakening, he saw the world in a new way. And this is the way he saw it. The way he saw the world, or not the whole world, but the way he was oriented towards it, the way he saw the path to freedom, the way he saw freedom, the new eyes that he had, awakening, you awake the Dharma eye. And so he saw this way. He saw, when it occurs, he saw suffering. He saw the compulsion, or the craving, the thirst, which gives rise to that suffering. And he saw the possibility of the seizing of that compulsion and that suffering. And he saw a path of life, a way of living, that followed from that seizing. So it's called to say he saw these four truths. Now, some people, when they hear the teaching, or they teach the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, they offer them prescriptively. This is a prescription. You should see it this, the world this way, and you should follow this path, and the Eightfold Path, and you'll become awakened too. But when he offered the another way of understanding what the Buddha was doing was he was not offering a prescription, but rather was presenting a description of the key insight that he now had, that when he surveyed the world and saw the world, he tended to see it through the framework of these four, or these kind of four approaches. When there's suffering, he was oriented to see it, oriented to see the cause of it, the cessation of it, and the how you behave once you seize your compulsion. And it's not meant, so I'm trying to present it here as a way of seeing as opposed to propositional truths. We hear many people in the English, they hear the word truth, they think, oh, these are tenets, creeds you have to follow or something. But they're more insights, and they have more to do with how to behave, how to act in the world, than it have to do with believing something. So with the first one, the noble truth of suffering, there's an action associated with it. And that action is to fully or thoroughly understand the suffering. So you're not told to believe your suffering. I believe in suffering, thank you. But rather, if there is suffering, you're asked to turn towards it and understand it, to study it, to be realistic about it. And so that's kind of the main point I wanted to make tonight, this idea of turning towards it. And that the insight of the Buddha was in part an insight of the value of turning towards it. And it's so valuable that in the Buddhist tradition, for the Buddha, it's called, it's associated with nobility, noble truth, and with certain kind of dignity or nobility or regality or something. And how is it that when you look at suffering, you see noble suffering? I suspect most of you have really a lot of good experience at ignoble suffering. The old-fashioned, grinding you down kind of suffering. I once heard Ajahn Jumyan, a Thai meditation teacher, say something like, he used the analogy of, I think, a really excessively hot day where you're kind of, oppressed by the heat. And he said there's ordinary oppression of the heat, ordinary suffering, and then there's noble suffering. And the ordinary one is when you're oppressed by it. Poor me, so hot, I can't stand it. And the noble one is when you take that suffering and see it in a new way, understand it in a different way, so that it's ennobling, so that it somehow frees you, so it somehow makes you a better person by the way you relate to it and hold it. Now, this is not a call, a teaching, go out and look for suffering. When I was a young Zen student, I went to my Zen teacher and said, if I sit in half lotus for a long time, my legs start to hurt a lot. But when they hurt a lot, then I'm really present. And so this is how stupid I was, right? So I said, maybe I should sit full lotus. So I can really be present all the time. And so the teacher says, Gil, don't go looking for suffering. Don't go looking for pain. Don't create it. But if it comes your way, then sit with it. So the teaching of of the First Noble Truth is not one that you're supposed to suffer. You need to suffer better. But if you happen to be a kind of person that occasionally suffers, or suffers a lot, then the teaching is turn towards it and study it, get to know it. So what is it you can get to know when you turn towards your suffering? And one of the very important things you can get to know is what is your relationship to your suffering? How do you relate to suffering? When you're in pain, when you're struggling with something, when you have a lot of sorrow or depression or anxiety or despair or discouragement or disappointment, how do you relate to the kind of discomfort of those things? And different people have different, I guess maybe personality types where they respond differently, maybe because of how they genetically are born or something. Some people respond because of ways they've been taught by their family or society. But there's some, a really good, I don't know good, but really popular strategies with suffering. So for example, I saw Charlie Brown's cartoon many years ago where Linus is talking to Charlie. Charlie's talking to Linus, and Charlie says to Linus, "Oh, so you don't think my father knows much about technology or something, fixing things? Well, just the other day, we were driving in our car, and there was this really loud clanging noise that came from underneath the car, from the engine." And Linus says, "Oh, don't tell me. So your father stopped and fixed the car." "No," says Charlie, "he turned up the radio." So that's one strategy, the avoidance strategy, I guess, or distraction strategy. And so I'd be curious to hear from some of you what you think. Not it doesn't have to be your strategy, but what are some of the strategies you've noticed that human beings have that are not so useful in relationship to suffering? Kind of, what are the things that, if you could take the mic, that would be appreciated too, right in front of you, Anne.
Most people I notice turn into a victim right away and put it on everybody. The suffering that they're having, it's because of you.
So the idea of being a victim. So that's a really great play some people are in. The good theater.
Yeah, get attention.
So get attention. So it's a way of getting attention. So that's one strategy, is to be the victim. I mean, some people are victims. It's not kind of, but there's a way in which it can be a quite unhealthy strategy of relating to suffering, to hold on to the idea of being a victim, being the victim. And then the other side of that is blaming someone else. I read many years ago a study of... they asked a whole bunch of convicts in prisons why they were in prison. And a very, very, very high percentage of them assigned a responsibility elsewhere rather than to themselves. So, what else? What other strategies? Yes, between.
So the opposite of that is blaming yourself. Judging yourself.
So blaming yourself, judging yourself. I'm wrong, I'm bad, I can't do this. That's a good play. Some people are really good at that. What else? People do. Way back there, in the corner.
There's also a kind of compulsion to have to change whatever it is that's bothering you.
Mm-hmm. So can you say a little bit more about that compulsion? Why do you use the word compulsion? And why is it a poor strategy? Why can't it be a poor strategy?
I guess because sometimes it makes it worse than... And it seems in some cases to be a misunderstanding of the situation. If it's something that you don't have control over, the idea of having to change it doesn't really make sense.
Mm-hmm. And then sometimes the situation's not asking to be changed. And maybe sometimes, like, if a friend of ours is suffering and we're uncomfortable, we're trying to change it not because we're trying to help the friend, because we don't want to be uncomfortable. And so it's a way of helping ourselves. And sometimes our friend is better left alone to reflect and process what's going on. Or sometimes, you know, the classic one is the friend just needs to have someone sit with them and hear them out, not be fixed. So what are there some other unhealthy ways of relating to suffering? Yes, if you can wait for the mic, please.
Substances.
Oh, the use of substances. So, substances. So, substances for distraction, for compensation, for avoidance, for denial. And so, alcohol, drugs, food, sex.
Anger and bullying other people, maybe.
So, kind of related to blaming, but anger and bullying. Uh-huh. So, sometimes. Some people suffer I went to St. Quentin on Friday, and some of you weren't here, but that's a year and a half ago I gave a talk from my visit there. I visited a violence prevention program among these convicts. And one of the sayings that they've developed apparently in that program was the saying that hurt people hurt, healed people heal. So the idea that if you're in pain, sometimes that stimulates people, it's catalyst people to kind of inflict more pain in the world around them. What else? David? Yes, please.
I find that I tend to cast about intellectually for solutions. Where I'll find a piece of suffering in myself and I'll go, what are you? What are you? How can I fix this? What about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? So that's my approach.
And what have you learned is the alternative to that? That's more healthy for you?
Just being attentive, because I find that when I do that, I still don't even know exactly what the suffering is, and that by trying to label it before I even know what's going on, it doesn't get me anywhere.
Great. So you tend to be too analytical? Intellectually analytical, thinking about it and all that, and without really having seen what it actually is.
Right.
Great.
I find that sometimes I can brace myself against it. It's as if I've hardened myself and I'm bearing it, but I'm not open to it fully. It's more like I've hardened myself and I'm just standing it for a while.
So it's kind of, it comes to mind, it relates to being stoic. You know, just I'm going to tough it out. You know, I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm not going to fix it. I'm just going to close down, bear down, brace, and just kind of somehow tough through it. Something. That's one way. Thank you. Someone else? Here, up in the front.
A lot of people will busy themselves with doing exercise, shopping online, working a lot, watching TV. It's just busy.
Getting
stuff,
really busy.
Distractions.
A lot of distractions. Busyness. Running around. It's kind of a you know, avoidance or distraction, perhaps. But yeah. Oh, people kill themselves as a way of trying to avoid it, thinking that maybe they'll not suffer that way. That's certainly a more dramatic way of doing it.
Sort of the grass is always greener on the other side. You know, dreaming of if I only get X, it'll all be better.
Oh, so going into fantasy world. You know, I'm suffering, and there must be a better world someplace else. And if I can just I'll just sit here and fantasize and daydream and not really address the suffering, but just dream about another possibility in the future, someplace, sometime.
And I think also fantasy about other people's suffering, so that it takes them away from their own suffering.
Hmm. So how does that work?
So, for example, if you are feeling upset, but you're kind of pushing it away and you're listening to the... Like today I was listening to the radio and there was a story about, someone remembering the wailing of a mother because she lost her son at war, and going into that person's suffering and really feeling that person's suffering to avoid your own.
Mm. Or maybe because you don't know how to feel your own.
Yes.
And then there's another thing I'm thinking of here. Someone talked about blaming other people. The kind of the flip side of that is to think someone else is going to be your savior. Someone else is going to help you. You know, someone else has a solution. And there's another strategy. And so sometimes not taking responsibility for oneself that way. Some of these things fit into the categories of what Buddhism calls the five hindrances. Five hindrances can be seen as strategies of how unhealthy strategies of dealing with personal challenges. So one strategy is desire, fantasy, going into or substance, going into having some kind of desire, something you want, from pleasure, delight, something that will take you away from your suffering so you don't have to deal with it. The second hindrance is ill will, blame, anger towards oneself, towards others, in some direction. And both these, desire and ill will, is a way of not really looking directly and seeing directly the suffering, engaging in it in a realistic way. And then there's what's called in our tradition sloth and torpor, but there's resistance, lethargy, giving up, and kind of just giving up. I guess that wasn't mentioned, was it? Just giving up? Maybe in yours way. And and then there's a fourth hindrance is restlessness, anxiety. So, you know, could be running around doing a lot of different things, being restless, running in circles, not just sitting down, just being with experience and really being seeing for what it is. And the last hindrance is doubt. So when we're challenged, sometimes people are filled with doubt, uncertainty, inability to make any decisions, kind of trapped in cycles of doubt. And so one of the functions of mindfulness practice, Buddhist practice, meditation practice, is to help us see, understand what our relationship is to suffering. And it's really important. So even before you look at your suffering, it's important to look and understand how you tend to relate to suffering. Because if you have ways of relating to it which are not helpful, then it's nice to be able to really identify those clearly for what they are, so that you can maybe not give in to it, so you can find another way of being with it. So you might spend some time reflecting in your life this next week, or noticing what are some of the strategies, what's like the top three that you have or the top one? What's your common tendency that you have? And it might be interesting not only to reflect on your own, this thing, but it might be interesting to go to a couple of really good friends that you trust, or wise friends that you trust, and ask them, you've known me for a while now, what do you think my strategy is? What do you think my most common way of relating to suffering is that it would be good for me to look at? Because maybe they have a different perspective than what you come up with. It might be interesting. And then, once you've done that, then perhaps you're in a better position to actually look directly at the suffering itself, to begin understanding it. Now, in order to want to do that, I think it helps to understand that there's good reasons to do it. Some people's relationship to suffering is, suffering has no purpose. It's just plain old suffering. It's going to wear me down. And there's no benefit in looking at it. And I certainly don't want to come to be part of a major world religion that basically is a kind of a party pooper religion. It talks about suffering, and now he's talking about, imagine a whole talk on suffering. I could have gone to some other sermon and been left inspired. And this is kind of a downer here today, suffering. But the idea of looking towards suffering is not so that we suffer better, but so that we understand it better so we can become free of it. And the whole purpose of Buddhism has that second part, so we can end the suffering, is a really important part. And to really understand, to really bring suffering to an end, you can get relief. You can be suffering a little bit, and substance abuse is a relief, perhaps. Distracting yourself is a relief. You can kind of leave the situation for a while and get relief. But what Buddhism looks for is not relief, but it looks for release. Release from the suffering. But it requires, and this is where the studying suffering is really important, it requires us to study what our contribution is to the suffering. What are we doing? What are we adding to the suffering? What are we adding to life that's causing the suffering? In fact, Buddhism has this very radical teaching. And it's a difficult teaching to offer because it has to be understood in context, or it has to be nuanced a little bit. But the full impact of it is that if you suffer, you're responsible for that. Now, that can be putting salt in people's wounds, because there are plenty of people in our society who suffer a lot because of terrible things other people do to them. And you're saying, now I'm responsible for this? No, you're not. But you don't want to say this to people in the wrong time. But when your mindfulness gets really strong, and you can understand and see the subtlety of how your mind works, then you see what happens what you contribute to situations you find yourself in. So, for example, if I say here tonight that I think people who wear socks are kind of silly. Now, chances are most of you who are wearing socks, some of you are wearing socks, it just goes right through. Man, what's Gil saying? It's like that doesn't really have much impact on you. It's a silly thing to say. But some of you might have looked down and wondered, uh-oh. One of the important Buddhist teachers in Redwood City. at least here on Birch Street has said, and I'm a silly person, and poor me, and I'm a terrible, and we latch onto, we cling onto it, and the whole idea of our self-image and how we get seen by someone else, and now I get angry with Gil. How could he, Buddhist teacher, say something about socks? It's so thoughtless. And we get pulled up, and we get pulled into kind of a whole kind of whirlpool, tornado of thoughts and angers and irritation or fear. Or it might be you get caught up in compulsive need to rush out and buy better looking socks or buy, some different kinds of, or something. I don't know. What I say about socks and what you do with it when you hear it are two very different things. You have to be responsible for what you do with hearing me say something silly about socks. It doesn't really, you know, that's really your responsibility there. If someone says, you know, swears at you in an angry way, it's very unfortunate. But in Buddhism, to find the path to freedom of suffering, from real release of suffering, the key thing as Buddhist practice is to look and see what are you doing inside you as a result of that. It's not to dismiss or deny the inappropriateness of someone yelling at you and being angry. It's not to say you shouldn't do something in the world, say stop that, or walk away from the person, or do something. But those kinds of practical things, which hopefully you'll do, is not where the path towards freedom is found. The path to spiritual freedom is found by being willing to study the suffering inside of you and to understand what is it you've contributed to it. What are you attached to? What are you clinging to? What are you holding on to? What are you trying to avoid, resist? How have you tightened up or contracted? What are you doing? And because if you can study that and see that, then there might be a possibility of releasing that, letting go of that. Relief can happen when the inner forces inside of you stay intact. Release happens when the inner forces inside of compulsion and attachment have let go of. So one of the things we do in mindfulness practice is we stop and look at suffering when it's there. And it's best to do it in the right time and place. You don't need to go look every opportunity you have. But there might be some times where you should really give yourself quality time to sit down in meditation or having a cup of tea or going for a walk or do something. Say, you know, I need to really be with this experience of my pain. And let me see if I can be with it and put aside some of these unhealthy ways in which I'm relating to it and see it in a new way. Now, one of the interesting new ways to see suffering, or one of the interesting ways of studying it, is to see if you understand what story you make together with the suffering. Because we human beings are story-making people. We love stories. So we start off with the idea of being a victim. I'm a victim. That's a story. And then we add to that story. You're to blame is a story. One other one is that if I suffer, I must have failed. Somehow I failed as a human being, I failed. Or another story is, if I've done everything right in my life, I'd be completely comfortable right now. That's a story. Or, there's all kinds of stories people can make up around suffering. Some of them have to do with their self-identity. Some have to do with their family history, their history of their community. Their stories. Some stories are more true than other stories. Some are completely made up. Stories about a relationship to other people, what these things mean. This means that I'll always be this way is one story. That I call it the delusion of permanence. One psychologist called it, I forget so well. So make up a story that's always going to be this way. Delusion of permanence. I've suffered. I remember once when I was, 19, I had this fantastic summer. And in the course of the summer, I had all this ecstasy. I felt ecstatic for days, weeks on time. And I remember thinking to myself, I'll never be depressed again. And then that fall, I was never more depressed than I'd ever been in my life until, that fall I got so depressed. This pendulum swung. And then I thought, oh, I'll always be depressed. This is it. Oh, the psychological expression was premature commitment. So you kind of commit yourself prematurely to some story, some idea. Ugly duckling had this premature commitment. So you might look at, you know, what's a story you make to suffering? And is there a better story? Sometimes Buddhism offers a different story. The whole life of the Buddha and his enlightenment is a story around suffering. It's a story that says that if you look at your suffering honestly, or even better, if you really stop and experience your suffering, don't hold it at a distance. Don't be afraid of it. Don't be angry at it. Don't be defensive about it. Let your mind, your heart get still and quiet in the midst of that suffering, and then really feel it and sense it. That if you do that, a number of things can happen. One is you might begin understanding the inner mechanism of your suffering, what your contribution to it is. Another thing that might happen, which I think is very profound, is that if you can just be present and feel how you suffer, your sadness, your grief, your anger, your fear, whatever, and not relate to it by in unhealthy ways, not pushing it away or holding on to it or reacting out of it, but just quiet and still and feel it, that the inner life will process that on its own, will help release it on its own, will move through it. It's kind of like some people have the experience with grief. If you allow for the right conditions, the heart knows what to do with grief. Your mind might not know what to do with it. That's why the mind gets so excited. You know, this is terrible, I don't know, I need to do something. But if you can let the mind be quiet and be very honest and feel the grief, without being for it or against it, without closing down, without blaming it, without saying it should be over by now, but make space for it. You might go through various phases with the grief, but those phases you go through is part of that inner wisdom that maybe knows what needs to happen. And then most people find, if they let they experience their grief in a healthy way, that it's a process that comes to some kind of conclusion that's healthy. So it's not only a matter of understanding the suffering that why we turn towards it, but also we turn towards it to allow some inner unfolding to happen that can't unfold if we're reacting to it and fighting it and doing this and that, trying to fix it and all that. Oh, yes. We have the mic. Someone wants to ask a question.
The question I have is about the definition of suffering, because to me the first definition comes to mind that I associate pain with it,
yeah.
From suffering and pain. Yeah. Pain has a huge range of...
Right.
And I'm now confused between the hindrance and... the hindrance are right. Tactics to avoid suffering, or they cause suffering?
Both. They do both. Pain is interesting, and for the most part, for now, what I'd like to say is that we distinguish between pain and suffering. Pain is physical pain, mostly physical pain. I mean, certain kinds of emotional pain, is like grief, is kind of as painful as well. But suffering is the what we add to the pain by our contractions, our resistance, our fear. Or the ways we cling, grasp, the whole slew of things where we feel sorrow, despair, anger, lamentation, all these things. And so the example I often give here is that if you're walking down the street, you might trip and hurt your toe, stub your toe, and that kind of thing happens in life, some variety of that. But then if I add to that, Gil, you're just, a disgrace as a walker. And I hope, you know, here I am, mindfulness teacher, and, you know, I should be mindful, and now I hope no one saw me. Oh, no, they saw me. This is terrible, you know. And my whole future as a meditation teacher is shot, and I get all, you know, that's all the addition to it. The story, the ideas, and all that.
Is it one story that things come down to end up being one story, and all these things that basically leads to, or there's no stories every day?
I think you should come back in a month and tell me. study it and find out how your story-making mind is. Buddhism does offer a story. And when it works well, it's a story to end all stories. So be present. So I was a little bit inspired to give this talk when I heard a friend of mine say that, Buddhist friend, that she trusts suffering. Isn't that quite a sentence, quite a phrase? To trust, she trusts her suffering. So do you trust your suffering? I think suffering is a messenger. Suffering has a teaching in it. And if you can turn towards your suffering, trust it. I mean, not that it's good to suffer, but if you're going to suffer anyway, trust it enough to see what the teaching is in it. What can you learn from it? In what way is your suffering a mirror for you to understand yourself better? And if you can trust your suffering, turn towards it, look at it, let it be a mirror, then your suffering will be noble. You'll be ennobled by your suffering rather than oppressed by it, weighed down by it, pulled down by it. Because it's really sad and it's very sad to me, very sad, that there are people who suffer a lot and are pulled down by their suffering. And I really hope that this path of practice here is one that pulls us out of the suffering, and that path of being uplifted, in a sense, begins in Buddhism by being willing to understand your suffering well. So that's fire and brimstone, IMC. Thank you all very much.